Spring is in the air, and at Minky Couture, we're celebrating this joyful season with warmth, love, and the softest, coziest blankets. Whether you're cuddling up after an Easter egg hunt or gifting a little extra comfort to someone special, our luxury blankets make every moment even sweeter. From our Minky family to yours, happy Easter. May your day be filled with love, laughter, and all the cozy moments you can dream of. Visit us online at minkycouture.com or stop by one of our stores to find your perfect Minky hug today.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. It's our special Taylor Elgersma episode, fellas. You ready for this?
Wow, Taylor Elgersma featuring Justin Dunk, the Canadian quarterback, lover of all lovers who loves Canadian quarterbacks, and we'll talk about them for the next 30 to 45 minutes. Tune in, folks. We will have other stuff to talk about, but first, it's the Justin Dunk, Taylor Elgersma special.
That's my man John Hodge. Of course, we are joined by JC Abbott as well. Yes, there's going to be a lot of Taylor Elgersma talking, rightfully so, but we're also discussing Alexander Hollins being paid a $75,000 offseason roster bonus following a successful CFLPA grievance.
Compensation for the CFL's next commissioner.
A possible first-round pick being added to this year's CFL draft.
The Hamilton Tiger Cats announcing their coaching staff for the 2025 season.
Calgary unveiling the logo for the inaugural Stampede Bowl.
And Nate Behar retiring from professional football. But first, Justin, you attended the University at Buffalo Pro Day where seven 2025 Canadian prospects perform. Most notably, QB Taylor Elgersma. Please regale us with everything you saw, the vibe, and what stood out to you the most.
The vibe was awesome, man. It was a beautiful spring day in Buffalo. Honestly, the pro day could have been held outside, but it was inside at the Murchie Family Fieldhouse. Full credit to the Buffalo Bulls staff who put on a first-class event. 17 NFL teams were in attendance, and a number of the NFL teams there, if not all of them, felt like the main attraction was Taylor Elgersma. And, you know, to another point before I get into Elgersma, fellas, the key takeaway from the day was that the Canadians, with all due respect, outperformed the Americans. Now, we as polite Canadians are respectful and grateful for the hospitality that the University at Buffalo showed, and even having Canadians at their pro day, because there are other schools in the United States that don't even have other players from smaller schools at their pro day because they want it just focus on their own guys. So first and foremost, I think that needs to be understood. Full credit to the Buffalo Bulls for having Canadians at the event. But there was no question that Elgersma was a centerpiece. So much so, fellas, that initially there were three quarterbacks scheduled to throw. All three of them threw, including the UB quarterback, and Taylor Elgersma was a feature. But they were going to go one rep each through the script. But the NFL teams wanted to see more from Elgersma. So essentially, he got, I believe it was two or three throws to every one throw for the other two quarterbacks that were there, because that's how much the NFL teams wanted to see Elgersma. And he quickly made it his house, fellas. He was vocal with the receivers, not just from an encouraging standpoint and celebratory standpoint as well after some great catches were made, but more importantly, pre-snap, he was reminding the receivers what the route was, what the depth was supposed to be, how they were going to break, come back to the football. Everything was being communicated in a timely fashion. And I think that stood out most in talking to some NFL teams afterwards about Elgersma's performance. We knew about his big arm. We've talked about it for a long time now on the podcast. But the fact that he went into a different country, a different school's pro day, and had no issue taking that leadership role really stood out to NFL scouts. So I'm not going to, even though as much as John Hodge wants me to, break down every single throw, but it was an impressive performance. He threw around 30 passes. The majority of those were completed. And the other thing that really stood out, fellas, is the fact that Elgersma only had one receiver that he'd ever worked with before. That was Ethan Jordan, an All-Canadian that he played with at Laurier at this pro day as well to throw to. But the other guys that he was throwing to, he tried to get some early time in with them. He had gone over the script with them to make it as good as it possibly was. And really, for the most part, he was on the money with all of these guys. Did he complete every deep ball? No, he wasn't perfect on the day, but he was pretty close to it. And I think that was two of the key takeaways, was his leadership and the way that in a situation that's less than ideal with players that you have never literally thrown to in a setting that has that kind of magnitude with 17 NFL teams there, really stood out. The one other note, and I didn't have it in the article after the pro day, but I think is important, is that there were NFL teams that wanted Taylor Elgersma to throw at the Buffalo pro day on a different day, closer to the Syracuse pro day, because Kyle McCord is throwing there, formerly of the Ohio State University, and all of the NFL teams were at that pro day. So NFL teams were telling Elgersma, his representatives, and Buffalo that if the Buffalo pro day was closer to the Syracuse pro day, let's say the day after or 2 days after, then all 32 NFL teams would have been there. Now, that could not have happened because the spring break for the university at Buffalo was during that week, which is actually this week. But I think that's noteworthy because this was NFL teams telling Buffalo, telling Elgersma's representatives, Fred Weinrauch and Craig Schaefer, that they all, the entire league, wanted to have an opportunity to at least have one representative there. So guys, I know we've heard a lot about Elgersma, but there were some other standouts. Real quickly, Devin Verisuk, an outstanding linebacker with the University of Windsor, put up combine noteworthy scores. I'm talking NFL combine noteworthy scores. Ran a 4.47 according to one NFL scout. He definitely looks the part. I've heard maybe his film doesn't match up, but from an athletic profile, he certainly has NFL measurables. So I think that's one of the other guys to really pay attention to as this draft process goes along.
The other Canadians in attendance at the University at Buffalo Pro Day were, as Dunk mentioned, Ethan Jordan, Elgersma's teammate from Wilfrid Laurier, Western offensive lineman Eric Anderson, York offensive and defensive lineman Brandon Davies Lyons, Queens defensive lineman Darian Newell, Verisuk, and Western defensive back Jackson Findlay. Now, most of these players, everybody minus Elgersma and Davies Lyons, will be at the CFL Combine in Regina later this week, where JC and I will be in attendance live, along with some other three-down contributors. Joel Gaston will be there. Brendan McGuire is going to pop in. And in there, I'm super excited to have so many three-downers on the field, if we're allowed to be on the field. But at present, at the Combine, that'll be great. The guy who stood out most to me, and I just am privy to the numbers here. I wasn't at the pro day, obviously, like you, Justin. By the way, did you eat buffalo wings while you were in Buffalo?
Nah, bro. I wanted to go back over the border and eat Canadian.
Okay, I respect that. I was about to get on you, but I respect that. I respect that. Darian Newell, who I had number two to the Hamilton Tiger Cats in my mock draft for Three Down Nation, checked in at 6'3", 287. And ran a sub 5 second 40-yard dash with a 34-inch vertical. Those numbers are crazy. I expected Newell to test well. That is better than I expected him to test, and it might be good enough that he ends up going down CFL draft boards. Why? Because, of course, when you test very well, if the NFL, right, all of a sudden sees you as maybe a more legitimate UDFA or maybe a late-round pick. I'm not suggesting that Newell will be a late-round pick, though. Anything's possible. Obviously, CFL teams are going to lower your stock because there's less of a chance of you showing up or whatever else. So I have his numbers from the East-West Bowl that he attended previously at the U Sports level, where he measured in at 6'3", 273. He only did 14 reps on the bench at East-West. At the Buffalo Pro Day, he did 27. Like, that amount of work that he's done in the gym, getting heavier, getting stronger, but yet keeping that athleticism. Like, he's moving well, he's jumping well. I think he is somebody who, you know, if you go to this pro day to watch a Buffalo prospect, or you go to watch Taylor Elgersma, I think you'd come away with it. And there were lots of other good scores. Don't get me wrong. Verisuk tested well. Jackson Finley's a testing beast. He's going to be one of the top testers at the combine. But I think you're going home with Darian Newell's name in your notebook going, okay, this is somebody we have to go back and watch the tape on, because there's a lot of guys coming out of college as that, you know, 285, 200 pound defensive lineman who are not posting numbers as athletic as this guy, who, by the way, was also a three-time first-team OUA All-Star, two-time first-team All-Canadian, and one-time second-team All-Canadian. So not somebody who didn't really pop off on tape, didn't put up a lot of stats, but is a testing monster. This guy's got the whole package. Now, for an NFL scout, I get that U Sports is a weird film to watch. You're not really sure the level of competition. But I think when you look at the athletes, you look at the eye test, you look at the numbers, he's got the full package right now to make a serious push for an NFL opportunity.
Yeah, I've been on the Darian Newell train for a while. And Hodge, you're a little bit on the outside looking in here, because I think you're the only one who hasn't seen Newell in person.
That's correct.
But this is a guy who runs between 287 when he checked in for his pro day. He can get up to 295 at his playing weight and does not look fat or chunky in any way. This is a guy who's just basically one whole chunk of muscle. Just a little ball of pure raw power and twitch, and stands out instantly the second he steps onto the field. Got an interview from the New England Patriots down when I was at CGS. I think he legitimately has a chance to be a UDFA in the NFL this season with everything that he's got, from those unique testing measurables to the on-field performance to the tape. Somebody like Devin Verisuk, absolute freak athlete, really impressive when he's moving around. I think gets a little bit lost at times in the shuffle when playing defense. The tape maybe isn't as clean. I liken him maybe more to somebody like a Luke Brubacher last year, who was a freak tester but didn't necessarily get an NFL contract, will probably go to a minicamp but maybe not sign despite those impressive numbers. But Newell, that guy is special, and I think him and Elgersma could be the two U Sports guys to get a serious, serious opportunity this upcoming or following the NFL draft. Elgersma, I think, has legitimately creeped into the back end of that draft. I'm at the point now where I would be more surprised if he didn't go in the seventh round or late in that draft than I would be if he was selected.
I could see Newell getting an opportunity, like you spoke about, JC, as an undrafted free agent. After his on-field workout, he talked to a handful of teams privately, including the Buffalo Bills, New England Patriots, Miami Dolphins, New Orleans Saints, Dallas Cowboys, Las Vegas Raiders, and Los Angeles Chargers. And then this tape is going to go out there from the pro day, and it's going to make other teams jump in and take a look at his film just based on the testing numbers. That's why these pro days can be so huge, is you can show your athletic ability, intrigue NFL teams to look into you more. That's what's happening with Newell. That is certainly happening with Verisuk, who wasn't as well known because of the tape, as you alluded to, JC. But when you post test scores like Verisuk did, that are either at the top of the board in the linebacker group from the NFL Combine or right there with the elite players in this draft from an athletic standpoint, then NFL teams are going to look into you. That's the case with Devin Verisuk. It's hard to pinpoint where potentially he could land. Is it a minicamp? Is it a UDFA? He's probably not a late round guy, but NFL teams are at least intrigued after what he was clocked at and what he put up. Like, we're talking about a guy who's 6'2", 232 pounds, 36 inch vertical, 10'4" broad jump, and then bench pressed just as many times as Darian Newell did, who's 287, 225 pounds, 27 times. Like, legit athletic profile. His relative athletic score is off the charts, but that tape needs to line up. Just back to Elgersma for 1 second, because I think it's important to note that people knew about his arm strength. Him going to the Senior Bowl really helped legitimize him as an NFL prospect. This pro day cemented his status. And in one instance, there was a team that sent somebody there specifically just to watch Taylor Elgersma. And, you know, we talk about U Sports film and the tape and how do NFL teams look at it. Well, I got a sense of that talking to some NFL scouts down there who are on both sides of it, who have seen U Sports tape before, Canadian University film before, and some who haven't. And, you know, there's some interesting comments, but like there's general managers out there asking their staff down the totem pole, like, what am I watching here? There's guys moving around. There's an extra dude on the field, yard off the ball. Like, you kind of got to explain it so they can get it. But I felt like one smart point was made that really at the snap of the ball, it's a very similar game. So when you look at it from that angle, and that's directly from an NFL team, that it makes it sort of apples to apples. The difficulty for some NFL teams is getting a feel for the competition level. But then, as you guys, I think, know now, there are NFL teams that view Canadian university football as, you know, Division II caliber, and depending on the team, it could be even higher. Some of the teams might be Division III that are not as good in Canadian university football, but it's getting more and more respect. So I got the sense, walking away from the pro day and everything that went on, that Elgersma really cemented his status as a legitimate NFL quarterback prospect who should have multiple undrafted free agent contract offers, if not, as JC alluded to, get selected in the late rounds of the 2025 NFL draft.
It is a hand time, but speaking of what Varisuk ran at 6'3", 230 pounds, I don't think in my 10 odd years of covering the CFL draft, I've seen a Canadian prospect, certainly not one from U Sports, who was over 6'1", over 220 pounds, and ran even sub 4.55, maybe sub 4.6. So even if this translates to, let's say, a 4.55 laser, that is still like off the charts fast. Like Alex Singleton was, I believe, a 4.52 guy out of basically that size. Now, I'm not saying that Devin Varisuk is Alex Singleton, but this is a great testing number. And the nice thing for Varisuk is that he plays a position that every single team in the CFL needs. Right, every CFL team needs Canadian players who, at the very least, can play all four teams, get downfield, wreak havoc, be fast, be physical, make noise. And they need those guys often to contribute as rookies. So this isn't a case where sometimes you draft an offensive lineman and then you go, okay, well, we're going to have to carry him on the roster, but he's almost never going to play. Or this isn't a case of a receiver where it's like, well, they're too small to play on special teams, so unless they're starting, there's not a lot of value. Linebacker is a position that all nine teams need in the draft every year because they need to fill up that body type on special teams. And I think that could give him a nice opportunity to develop and potentially become a CFL starter. He's certainly got the size and athleticism to play Mike or Will, and we'll have to wait and see if he develops into that starter down the line. The BC Lions have paid Alexander Hollins his $75,000 off-season roster bonus after the CFL Players Association won an injury grievance. The 28-year-old receiver was cut in January before the payment was due after undergoing arthroscopic knee surgery. Shout out to me for my pronunciation of arthroscopic. What's next for Hollins and the Lions? I was worried about that one.
Well, there's a couple of different factors at play here. First of all, the root of the issue for the uninitiated is that veteran players are not allowed to be cut in the CFL while they are hurt. So once Alexander Hollins was released, the CFLPA reached out to him, said, hey, what's your situation? Because general manager Ryan Rigmaiden had let slip in a press conference that he had recently undergone knee surgery, and they had him tested by an independent doctor who said, hey, he's not able to play right now. He is not healthy enough to step on the field, which makes this an illegal release in the CFL rulebook and entitles him to the money he would have received had he been on the roster. Now, from the Lions and Hollins perspective, there's a couple of different ways you can go forward here. First of all, he can simply just receive that $75,000 and remain a free agent. That means the Lions pay that out to him and he can sign with any other team for whatever they are willing to pay him. He could come back on his existing contract that he previously had signed that the Lions were trying to get out of by releasing him, or the two sides could come to some sort of middle net ground and renegotiate. All of those things are currently being considered at the moment. I've been told from the Alexander Holland side of things, he'd be open to returning to BC. I think the Lions are a little bit more lukewarm in terms of whether or not they want him back, but certainly this is a awkward situation to get caught out publicly like this, making the mistake of cutting a guy while he is hurt and then having to pay that out. Because if Hollins ends up with another team, the Lions are essentially paying part of his salary, because a team will get a little bit more of a discounted rate to bring him in because he's already got that $75K in the bank.
Full credit to the Canadian Football League Players Association for providing Three Down Nation an exclusive statement and helping not only us, but the fans understand what the PA does on a day-to-day basis, or in this case, I'll say case-to-case basis, because I think they laid it out well in their statement. They talk about how they facilitated an independent medical assessment by a neutral physician in British Columbia to check Hollins out. They didn't just say, oh, well, Hollins tells us he's hurt, you need to pay him his bonus. They went through the actual proper steps to confirm this and then filed the grievance with the Lions. So I think to me, that's one of the interesting parts of this, is that it shows that there's so much of this that goes on behind the scenes, but small amounts of it ever make it out to the general public. Because some people might sit there and say, well, what does the CFLPA do on a daily basis? Well, literally every time, especially after a veteran player gets cut, and in this instance for sure, they're going to look through that situation and make sure everything in the collective bargaining agreement was adhered to. That in and of itself is a big job, let alone all the other things that the PA is doing to try to hold themselves to a consistently high standard. So I'm appreciative, yes, because we got the statement, but also because it helps us understand the situation from their perspective. It's worth saying that we did reach out to the BC Lions for comment. They declined to do that in this situation, but I'm sure JC will have questions for General Manager Ryan Rigmaiden at the CFL Combine, so keep it locked to threedownnation.com for the Lions' perspective, or at least what Rigmaiden has to say about this really, I don't want to say rare in a sense, but I think it kind of is, fellas, a rare situation that has happened here where it can go in multiple different directions.
Yeah, I'm as big of a CFL nerd as anybody, and I can't remember the last time that I heard of a player getting a bonus after they'd been cut for this reason. So kudos to the PA for sticking up for Alexander Hollins, and kudos to Alexander Hollins for getting his money. Ryan Rigmaiden, for the record, in January said that he believes when healthy, Alexander Hollins is arguably the best route runner in the league. And when I look at the receiving core they've got in BC, they did part ways temporarily with Keon Hatcher before eventually bringing him back on a reduced deal. So maybe there is still a path for Hollins and the Lions to have a reunion here. Obviously, Hollins would not be making what he was scheduled to make in 2025, but at least he got his bonus to carry him through the offseason. And if I'm the CFLPA, and this is just my opinion, but something that I would like to see in the future is the PA not just doing this for veteran players, but negotiating in it right into the CBA, even for non-veteran players, some type of injury settlement. We see it all the time in the NFL, where guys go to a camp and get released with injury settlement. And every year in the CFL, there's at least one player who comes up for training camp, having never played in the league before, and lo and behold, they tear an Achilles, or they suffered an ACL tear or some other serious injury, and they literally get nothing except for a plane ticket home, as far as I know. And I would like to see a situation, and I'm not saying that these guys should get their full salary for the year, but is there a way to at least get them something? Say, hey, you're going to get the equivalent of 8 weeks of practice roster money. Is that a life-changing amount of money? No, but it's something to at least carry players through who have to come up to camp, aside from preseason, don't get paid, and are risking themselves to injury. So I would like to see a system where not only are veteran players protected, but maybe there's something that could be done even for rookie players. And I know the union, generally speaking, doesn't have the same vested interest in protecting first-year players, because not only are they not union members, but they're actually trying to push union members out of the league by winning those roster spots and winning those jobs. But in my opinion, the rookies still deserve to get paid at least something for training camp. And if they do suffer an injury, I would like to see some type of situation where their income list is supplemented, because if there is currently a system like that in place, I'm not aware of it.
I've seen a lot of people.
At Ritual, we know what goes into the holiday season. The potluck planning, the gift giving, the spreadsheets. So this new year, take a moment for yourself with science-backed support that puts you first. So whether you're focusing on supporting foundational health with a clean vegan multivitamin or supporting your gut health with Symbiotic Plus, do it with 30% off your first month at ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Make the comment from the team perspective that this is a massive blunder by the Lions and first-time GM Ryan Rigmaiden. And while I do think they have a degree of egg on their face here because it has become public, I think we have to look at the situation a little bit with a little bit more nuance because of some of the factors at play. First of all, had they not released Alexander Hollins, they also would have had to pay $75,000 for a player that they may have cut ultimately later down the line. So that amount of money is the same regardless. How they could have prevented that is, I think, where it gets a little bit more interesting. We don't know if the Lions reached out in advance of him having the surgery to potentially renegotiate his contract before that bonus and what those conversations looked like if they happened, if Hollins' side would have been amenable to that. I think that's a big unanswered question here. Also, I think the Lions pushing their postseason decision-making down the line because of hosting the Grey Cup hurts them a little bit in this situation, because we know that Alexander Hollins had the surgery in December. And for all intents and purposes, this is not a extremely, as far as surgeries go, extremely invasive, serious surgery. It still knocks you out for a little bit, but it's more of a cleanup procedure. And before that, he was playing on the injury. He was, for all intents and purposes, healthy based on the CFL definition. So if you are able to cut him early, late November after the season, early December before he goes in for this optional procedure, you're not on the hook for this because he is ruled healthy. The Lions couldn't do that because they hadn't made decisions on who was going to be in charge of the team going forward. They didn't want it to affect the way that the Grey Cup was perceived. And with that all getting kicked down the road, they couldn't necessarily get ahead of this. So they were in a bad situation. Ultimately, they are going to look bad publicly, and nobody's going to feel sorry for them because ultimately they're releasing a popular veteran player in a bad moment. But I'm not sure there was a ton else they could have done if they wanted to get out from underneath that massive contract for a player who, let's be frank, underperformed last season. Dunk, you wrote an article stating the CFL needs to raise the compensation for its next commissioner if the league truly wants to hire a difference maker. Why is that your opinion?
It's an informed opinion because it came after talking to some people who some might think would be considered for the role. And really, when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. And I have to address one thing, because some of the comments on social media afterwards were talking about, well, the CFL isn't like the NFL, let's say, for example, in terms of how much money it brings in. That has nothing to do with this. It's when you have business leaders, public, private, or leaders who are in the sports world, when they look at what the CFL commissioner has to do with regards to its business, which I was told from sources is estimated, the revenues are to be between $200 and $300 million, that's less than 1% in terms of what the commissioner takes home as a salary when you base it off at least the front end, the $200 million level. And I was told that, according to sources, Randy Ambrosi's commission is around $750,000 annually, I should say salary, and it can get up to the $1 million level because there are some incentives in his contract. So when people who are at that level in the business world look at the job, they just say, well, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. And then you add into it the fact that there's no real unilateral decision-making power. I'm not saying the commissioner should have that for every single decision, but you essentially have to kowtow, or at least in the past, have had to kowtow to the nine owners who act somewhat independently when the betterment of the league is on the line. They've had a difficult job coming together, at least in my opinion, and from the people that I've talked to. So I think when you put all those factors into the mix, it makes sense that to these people who are out there in this type of earnings bracket, let's call it, that it's simply not worth it because it doesn't have the upside and it doesn't tie in terms of what the league's business is. So I do think that there is some, what would the right word be? Factual backing to the argument. People might say, well, now you have Amar Doman in there and Larry Thompson and Pierre-Carl Péladeau in terms of the board of governors that will make this new hire look different than commissioners in the past. And I think there is some credence to that. But the one area where I think we can actually compare it to the major sports leagues in North America is the lack of longevity. Like, you look at the NHL, Gary Bettman assumed office in 1993. Don Garber with Major League Soccer, JC, August 1999. Roger Goodell with the NFL, September 2006. Rob Manfred with Major League Baseball, September 2013. Adam Silver with the NBA, February 2014. In Silver's case, he was the right-hand man to David Stern, and it was passed off to him. Like, when people are put in these roles in these major sports leagues that have grown immensely, there is longevity there. Whereas since 2014, you had five people, including interim executives, in the commissioner role. So then you have these business executives viewing it as a role that they feel like, in their words, is potentially being hired to be fired. And it makes sense when you compare them, at least from a tenure standpoint, to the, let's say, five big time sports leagues in North America.
I want to first credit you, Justin, for not only using the word kowtow on this podcast, but also in your article. That word is not used nearly enough. It is one of the best words. I will say this. If you're the CFL and you just want a figurehead who, you know, during the season walks around and shakes hands and kisses babies, and then when speaking to the media or when making an unpopular decision that in some cases you've probably not made, but like other people have made and you're going along with, you're like the public punching bag. If that's all the job is, then I'll do it. And I'll do it for $500K. Okay? I'll do it. I'm used to taking crap on social media. That's par for the course for a reporter in 2025. And I'm happy to just do what people tell me. Because for $500,000 a year, that sounds like a pretty sweet gig. And I'm saving you money relative to what you were paying Randy. If you want a true business leader who is going to take the CFL to the next level and help develop the business on the gambling side, which is kind of a new revenue stream, the media rights, which are coming up at the end of the 2026 season, which are going to be a huge, huge factor in how the CFL is potentially able to grow and change and develop, whether that means staying with TSN exclusive, whether that means branching out into other, but whether that means having a specific streaming deal with somebody, like there are all kinds of opportunities available to this league. And that's, by the way, not just English language, that's French language. The league also has an American television deal that's paying them a little bit of money relative to gross league revenues. Maybe that can grow. Maybe there's money to be made elsewhere. But regardless, I do think that it makes sense to do one of two things. Either make a big splash and spend the money and bring in a really, really sharp person, or if this is going to continue to be a mom and pop shop, why are you paying $750? Like, why are you doing that? If this person is just a punching bag and a puppet, and I'm not saying that Randy was just a punching bag and a puppet. I'm being a little bit flippant. I'm sure that there are actual decisions that he made, and there are things that he handled well. And I've never been a commissioner of a popsicle stand, much less a league. So there are things that I'm sure dealing with, you know, for instance, discipline with the Chad Kelly situation. I don't envy anybody having to navigate that and make those decisions. I get it. But if this person on a day-to-day basis is just a, I'm going to have a beer with the fans and walk around and say nice things about the CFL, then why are you wasting your money? Invest it elsewhere. You shouldn't be paying someone $750,000 for that. That doesn't make sense to me. So that's my thought. Either go bigger and invest the money or dial this in, because there's a handful of governors running the league anyway. And the commissioner is just the face. So why are you paying a face all of this money? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I'm going to preface my comments by saying I thought this was a wonderful article by you, Dunk. Well written, well researched. I know the sources you talk to, how connected they are. This is not a slight against your piece in the slightest. But when reading it, my first thought is, cry me a damn river. Okay? I think there is absolutely zero correlation between upping the salary for the CFL commissioner and getting a more competent person to be the CFL commissioner. It's still a highly paid position. Ultimately, I think with all the limitations that are inherent with the role, and I don't think can ever be changed, both from a structural standpoint of it being a small league and all the different dynamics behind the scenes, it's never going to be a truly enticing position for the type of business leaders we are talking about when we want to double or even triple the potential salary offer. I don't think those people are ever going to seriously consider it. And even if they did, people who get highly paid across politics, across business, you look around the world right now, some of the most incompetent individuals on the face of the planet are also some of the highest paid. There is not a correlation there in my mind. And to Hodge's point, which I think is brilliant, what I would personally like to see from the commissioner's office is maybe roll that salary back, get somebody who's competent and passionate, but invest some of that money in actually beefing up the league office and having more than one person in there, because I think they are chronically understaffed. I think there are not enough powerful voices in this league right now. I think the only way to create more innovation and get this league to grow as a business is actually to bring in a higher quantity of people who are up and comers and can see things and can challenge convention rather than one big decisive voice. Heck, spend some of that money on a damn PR consultant so you don't have a commissioner that sticks his foot in his damn mouth every time he steps behind a podium. Like, there are other ways you can spend this money. Woo! Besides going $2-3 million for a commissioner who ultimately I don't think will move the needle that much. Let's invest that into the league in the whole instead of paying out a big check to a guy in a fancy suit.
Well, you don't need to hire a PR consultant when you can just have Kate Burness ask the questions instead, which is what they did at Grey Cup this past year.
It's true. In fairness, am I wrong? He didn't even do a good job at that. So
there's multiple angles to this, fellas. And, you know, you bring up that point about Grey Cup, all right? And the three of us have heard this. That was one of the things, let's put this nicely, that Randy Ambrosi feared most, I suppose. That's a way of putting it nicely. But as a commissioner, arguably the most important part of your job is conveying the league's vision to the public. So that's where this thing starts to me, is that whoever is brought in as the next commissioner needs to have elite public relations skills and be confident in communicating any initiative, view, future vision, whatever it is about the league to the public, be it with reporters at Grey Cup firing finely crafted questions, or it's fans who arguably, and sometimes do, ask better questions than the media.
True.
Right? Like, and that could be in a small one-on-one setting when, you know, let's say I've seen Randy Ambrosi walking around Mosaic Stadium. CFL fans are always yelling out questions and asking him and bothering him, like when he was on the set with us inside the Harvard Studio 620 lounge. So like, you have to be comfortable doing that. And if you look back, a lot of people, and I think there's some that didn't necessarily love him, but I would say a big part of the CFL's core fan base loved Mark Cohan. And that was because for the majority of his tenure, from what I can remember as a younger reporter, you know, he could convey that. He could talk competently, consistently about the league. And then you look at that structure to the point you guys made about the salary. He had Michael Copeland there, you know, essentially running the business. And that was one of the times where the CFL saw an uptick. The TSN television deal was signed, and that grew the league, which they've kind of been in a holding pattern since. So perhaps that model is valid. And the other point that you guys brought up that I think needs to be discussed here is, are the CFL Board of Governors going to continue the same way that they've done for years and years and years while the CFL has sat stagnant? Do those people who legitimately control the league from behind the scenes and make Randy Ambrosi in this instance the punching bag want to cede that power and actually listen to different voices, or God forbid, have a visionary as a commissioner come in there and lead the league? That's one part. The other part of it is, and I get it because, you know, we see this in politics and even our own lives, you know, a mayor of a city is always advocating for things to improve their city. They're not so concerned about the rest of the country. The CFL needs to be concerned about the league as a whole. And I get that teams have wants and needs. You don't have to look any further than the schedule being delayed. But for the betterment of the league's future, there needs to be a come to Jesus moment, for lack of a better term, where people are more used to working together and coming together. I'm not saying they never do, but this new hire for a commissioner is going to be a landmark hire, because that media rights deal is absolutely massive and critical, fellas, for the league's future. It cannot be overstated. So this hire, I believe, needs to have some real potential unilateral but decision-making power. Cannot kowtow to the Board of Governors anymore. And I do believe, from talking to people around the league, that that could change, especially with Amar Doman in the mix and some of the new views that the other owners, Pierre-Carl Péladeau, Larry Thompson, bring to the table. But there needs to be a seminal shift in the way that the Board of Governors do business. Otherwise, the league is going to stay stagnant. And if you look at the sports landscape, if you're staying stagnant, you are lagging well behind. You know, I hesitate to bring this example up, but if you look at, it wasn't that long ago, the CFL could compete with the NFL in terms of salaries. Now, people will laugh and say, oh, you can't make that comparison. But there was a time where American college stars came to play professional football in Canada instead of the United States. But look at the CFL salary cap as an example compared to the NFL salary cap. People will say, well, the CFL just doesn't have the same money. You go back not too long ago, the CFL was bringing those stars up here. You know, the business had at least a chance to trend upwards. I'm not saying it could have been the NFL, but the NFL wasn't the NFL it is today during that time. So let's start taking ourselves away from those thoughts of, you know, well, it can't be the NFL or it can't be this. We need a commissioner who is a visionary, a leader, who can put this league on a pedestal and push it to another level. And I think it starts with a bunch of these issues that we are talking about within the league that don't often get discussed. And a lot of decisions are made that Randy Ambrosi has to live with, to be quite honest, that he might get forced to deal with that ultimately affects his legacy. Like, that's what we're talking about here when we're talking about, like, the increased compensation, excuse me, because some people might say, well, hey, you get what you pay for. And I respect what JC is saying that, yeah, money's not necessarily going to solve everything, but there are other details here that are critical to attracting. It's not just who does the CFL look at as their commissioner. It's who views that position as one that's attractive to even put their name into the mix.
Well, with that impassioned speech, Justin is striking me as a candidate for commissioner, so I hereby lower my price to $450. $450 is now the price.
Hey, I'll go for $250, and I'll put my foot in my mouth.
JC, at least as much as Randy did. At least. Well,
you're getting the same performance for $500,000 less. I too can go in front of Parliament and ask for insane amount of money.
I'm the market, bro. You just killed the market. And you live in Vancouver. You need to be asking for more than $250. Come on.
That's true. I can't even buy a house.
Yeah, your asks should be flipped based on where you live.
Yeah, that's true. You could probably live better in Winnipeg at $250 than Vancouver at $450. I don't disagree with any of that necessarily. I don't love the NFL comparison. I agree with what I think the heart of your messaging, which is that we should believe that the CFL can grow. I don't disagree with that. I think that the difference in scale has gotten so unbelievably different that it's kind of meaningless to compare the two.
It is now. I agree.
It is now. Like it's just, you know, and
but when
really,
you look at where the NFL was in some of these other leagues, you can see the growth. Like, just look at Major League Soccer.
I mean, I'm not an expert on Major League Soccer. From what I understand, Major League Soccer doesn't sell a tremendous amount of tickets and their ratings on television are not strong. But the valuation of franchises has grown tremendously. I would probably chalk that up more so to the global interest in soccer than how many people are actually invested in being fans of Major League Soccer, where the CFL kind of has the opposite problem. The ticket sales are up. There's a ton of people very passionate about the league. The numbers are pretty good on television, but nobody wants to own any of these things because they're generally not moneymakers. Why? Well, in part because outside of Canada, there's a very limited interest in it, right? It's a bit of a niche product versus soccer, where billions of people around the world know and care about soccer. Canada, Canadian football, a little bit more niche, a little bit more limited. What I will say, a little bit in defense of Randy, is I also think it's somewhat unfair to compare the Cohan commissionership versus the Ambrosi commissionership. Mark Cohan had Jim Hobson come in and revolutionize the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. Randy Ambrosi had multiple ownership crises and a global pandemic. So, like, to that end, I don't think it's a fair comp. That being said, did Mark
Cohan... I'm not comparing them like one-to-one.
I get that.
Structure for the potential new role.
I get what you're saying with that. And I will also say, who was the better messenger and who was the better communicator? Absolutely Mark Cohan, 100%. I'm not arguing with that. At the end of the day, the CFL, I agree, is at a pivotal point. They have survived the COVID pandemic. Things seem to be starting to trend upward. Coming out of the recovery from the COVID pandemic, if they want to continue that upward trajectory and not just survive, but actually thrive, I agree. This is a pivotal hire, which is why they should not be hiring JC at $250. They should be hiring me at $450. And that is my final offer. Okay, $400. $375? $350? Okay.
Todd, you're coming down quick, bro. You got to hold your position.
$249.999. Come on. $249.999. I'm a dollar under JC.
What is this, Price is Right?
Yeah. Well, hey, it's less money.
We got to get t-shirts done up. Hodge for commissioner.
Or what about this? JC and I co-commissioners, $450 combined. So we each get $225. And if JC, if something popular happens, like there's something to celebrate, I'll do the media. If something terrible has happened or we need someone to take the guff, we're sending out the cheese.
There we go.
I think that sounds great. I'll be having beers with fans. JC can answer the tough questions. I think that sounds great.
Diary of a Wimpy Kid, man. You don't want to touch stinky cheese. I don't know if I want to touch JC if he's upset.
Don't touch the cheese.
Don't touch the cheese.
All right, boys. Hodge, you reported that Canadian offensive lineman, and yes, this is his name, Tiger Shanks, I repeat, Tiger Shanks, has been added to the 2025 CFL draft. Who is this prospect by the name of Tiger Shanks? Because he doesn't sound real. And could he realistically be taken with the number one overall pick?
I don't think it's impossible. It will ultimately depend on his NFL options. But Tiger Shanks is an excellent CFL prospect, in my opinion. His story is a unique one. And by the way, this is not a case of what some people would term a fake Canadian, where it's like, oh, this person has lived and been raised in the United States their entire lives, but they have a Canadian parent who spent like 2 years in Red Deer, Alberta, and now they're Canadian. He was born in Vancouver. I have since communicated with Tiger Shanks since reporting this via text message. He doesn't remember how old he was when he left Vancouver, but his mother, who was a Chinese model and entrepreneur by the name of Carrie Yu, left Vancouver with the family to live in China for, he said, 4 to 5 years before eventually settling in the United States. So he himself is not exactly sure of the timeline, which I think is forgivable considering he was an infant and toddler at the time. But regardless, this is someone who was born in Canada, raised in China, eventually settled in Lake Oswego, Oregon. I hope I'm saying that right. He has started 51 games at right tackle at UNLV, 6'5", 325 pounds, a two-time first-team all-conference selection the last 2 years. According to Pro Football Focus, he allowed only 11 pressures and one sack over 410 pass-blocking snaps in 2024. So if you're looking for a CFL comp, my comp might be someone like Dante Bull. I think Tiger Shanks has a better frame than Dante Bull, but Dante Bull was the number one overall pick a couple of years ago because he was a multi-year starter at tackle at Fresno State. I would say, JC, you know better than me, Fresno State, maybe a tiny bit of a step up from UNLV in the Division I ranks, but they're pretty comparable programs.
They're in the same conference, so yeah.
Exactly.
UNLV is a better team right now than Fresno State by a,
and there you go.
A wide margin.
It's been a long time since UNLV generated generated an NFL draft pick in any round. They have had some NFL or some CFL players. Kyle Saxelead as a starter at UNLV has been in the CFL since 2018. Shaq Murray Lawrence, I believe, was a UNLV grad, now bobsledder, but had a nice career as a CFL special teamer, kind of spot running back. But at the end of the day, Shanks, I think, projects as a possible starter. Like if he was American as a 4-year starter at UNLV, I think he would be the type of guy who would come as an American to camp and get a legit shot to play tackle. Tackle is a spot that a lot of teams are having trouble filling, be it Canadian or American right now. There is a shortage. So I believe he will get at least a UDFA opportunity. We'll have to see how he tests. He will be participating at the UNLV Pro Day on March 24th. So we don't have any athletic testing numbers for him. We'll have to wait and see. If he tests super well, he's probably a late round pick in the NFL. If he doesn't test well, he's probably a UDFA. And it's possible that he'll never come to the CFL. But what we do know is that he has done the paperwork fairly recently to get into the CFL draft. To me, that means that he is at least somewhat interested in coming to the CFL. If he is not an NFL guy, I think he could be a very high pick in this year's CFL draft. And by the way, one of the reasons Dante Bull ended up in the CFL right away is he was, of course, coming off a broken leg he sustained in his last year with the Bulldogs at the collegiate level. Tiger Shanks is healthy, so I do expect him to get some NFL opportunity. But to me, he could very well project as a ratio-breaking tackle in the CFL, and I think he's a prospect well worth keeping an eye on. If he had been in the draft before I released my first mock draft, I probably would have put him in round one.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to still be determined in terms of the evaluation of Tiger Shanks as we get to know him a little bit more. I'm interested to see how long his arms are, to see how legitimate his shot as an NFL tackle will truly be. He's not quite as tall as Dante Bull was, but he's heavy. He's listed at 325 pounds. That's a little bit more than you typically see for a CFL tackle or a CFL offensive lineman in general. But what you love about the numbers and the raw data when you take a peek at Tiger Shanks is he is a dramatically better pass protecting player than he is just as a pure run blocker, which is typically not the case for guys who are on the bigger side. Typically, they're the maulers and the grinders and the people movers. No, he's got some nice feet. He's really effective out there at tackle. 11 pressures last year. 2 sacks given up over the last 2 seasons combined. The first offensive lineman in UNLV history to be a 2-time all-conference selection. This guy, I think, has the potential to be really, really special if he comes up to the CFL at any stage.
It's now time for Hodges' Heritage Moment. On this day in 2009, Dapi Darsh, which I hope I'm saying correctly, was released by the Kansas City Chiefs, ending his 9-year NFL career. A star linebacker at McGill, the Montreal native became a full-time long snapper at the professional level, who served as a captain with the Seattle Seahawks in 2005 and 2006. Darsh attended medical school following his NFL retirement, and now serves as one of Kansas City's 6 team doctors, a role he's held since 2020. Do you guys think Darsh and Laurent Duvernay-Tardif are the only 2 people who have played for the Chiefs and become medical doctors?
Got to be the only Canadians to do that.
Oh, they both went to McGill. Like, shout out McGill. It's just wild. Churning out NFL doctors, which is crazy.
I believe Andy Reid's mother went to McGill as well, which is a wild connection.
Yes, I read that somewhere, which is a fascinating coincidence. But it's wild that there have been 2 notable Canadian NFL players to become medical doctors, and they both, A, went to the same school, and B, played for the same NFL team. You just can't make up connections like that.
And you just have to hope and pray, by the way, that none of these guys are the children of your friend's parents, because nothing would be worse than catching up with your mom and being like, oh, I talked to Susie and her son is now a doctor after retiring, making millions of dollars in the NFL. And you're like, yeah, well, I ordered Skip the Dishes for lunch and then forgot to walk the dog today. So that's how my life is going. So well, I hope that my parents are never friends with any of the parents of these people.
Make sure you walk your dog, Hodge. Don't forget.
Yeah, I walk her. It's hard these days because Winnipeg is just a big sheet of ice right now. It is awful. I fell last week. I almost broke my hip. I swear to God.
Bro, it's 19 degrees. Move to Ontario, man.
If I had the money. If I get hired as the commish, sounds good. I'll be there. Okay, 225. You twisted my arm. 225. Final offer.
Fun fact or related note to people's kids. JP Darsh actually has a son who will be CFL draft eligible in a few years. He's a long snapper at Penn, currently in the Ivy League. So that's a name to look out for down the line.
Of course JC knows about an underclassman Canadian long snapper at
Penn. Sophomore long snapper at Penn.
I can't wait to read the JC Abbott headline one day. Second generation long snapper. So-and-so Darsh, ready for 2027 CFL draft.
What's his name, JC?
I believe it's Zach Darsh.
Zach Darsh. Look out for him. In what draft would he be in?
2 years from now if he continues with his current eligibility. So that would be...
Possibly in the 2027 CFL draft. Yeah. Perhaps NFL draft.
Perhaps.
You never know. Let's go to the 3-minute drill. Potential first overall 2025 CFL draft pick. Linebacker Connor Shea ran a 4.52 second 40-yard dash during his pro day at Wyoming. That's got to help his stock, right?
It will. And that could actually, I think, lower his CFL draft stock, because if you at 6'3", 225 pounds, are running 4.52, I think you're much more likely to get an NFL opportunity versus if you ran, let's say, in the high 4.6s, low 4.7s. So that will be something to watch. Could his rising NFL stock lower his CFL draft stock? Longtime CFL defensive back Luchez Purifoy has joined the coaching staff at Tate High School in Florida. Is that a good fit?
You always love to see successful CFL players giving back to the next generation. What I want to know, is he going to bring that, like, what is it? It? The It clown doll with him to all the high school practices?
Pennywise the clown, yes.
Pennywise the clown.
Maybe.
Does that fly at the high school level? I'll be intrigued to find out.
It's Florida. Anything flies in Florida.
He can set it right on top of the meth gager that watches the games.
Exactly.
The Dallas Cowboys signed Canadian offensive lineman Dakota Shepley to a 2-year contract extension. How impressive has his NFL career been?
It's pretty impressive, man. You consider where he was at the University of British Columbia, was, I believe, selected in the first round by the Saskatchewan Roughriders, spent some time there, and then now has been in the NFL since 2020, going from the Niners to the Seahawks, to the Cowboys, to the Colts, and then now back again with the Cowboys. And he's going to make, you know, if this contract, he plays it all out, he's going to be over $2 million in total compensation for his NFL career. That's the kind of money Hodge would like.
220. 220. 215? My phone's still not ringing.
You said 225 final offer, and it keeps going down. So I think we can grind you down more.
Yeah, they kind of called my bluff.
Former Saskatchewan Roughriders running back Jamal Morrow has retired from the CFL at age 30. How will you remember Morrow?
I mean, he made some great plays as a running back, as a returner in Sask. Unfortunately, I think I'm going to mostly remember just how the injuries towards the end of his career hampered him. Tried to get on the field with Calgary, couldn't. Tried to get on the field with Ottawa, got on the field for one game and then out. So I think it'll be one of those cases of what could have been, fortunately. The Calgary Stampeders unveiled the logo for their inaugural Stampede Bowl. Was it a hit or a miss for you?
It was a hit for me. I love the concept. I think the CFL needs more marquee named games. And the Stampeders themselves have one of the most bland, horrific logos in, I would argue, all of professional sports, but certainly the CFL. I think this was pretty cool, the whole metallic horse look. I think it's better than what they actually wear on the side of their helmets. Canadian defender Michael Hoyt, who signed a 3-year, $18 million deal with the Buffalo Bills in free agency, has been suspended 6 games for a PED violation. Is that disappointing?
It is. JC, I know you don't care about PED violations, but it is definitely disappointing. I understand the mindset somewhat, being a professional athlete, trying to gain an edge or, you know, keep up with the Joneses and earn this kind of money. But it was honestly shocking to me that a guy like Michael Hoyt, with his background and pedigree from where he went to university, would be caught for something like this, just to be flat honest.
Well, I mean,
Hamilton Tiger.
In fairness, we should give Hoyt's explanation as well, which is that he was provided supplements by a trainer that he trusted and took them without double checking, which he took responsibility for, and has essentially said he trusted the wrong people. So whether you buy that or not, I don't know, but he has taken responsibility for essentially not doing his due diligence and trusting the people he was paying to help train him in the offseason.
That's fair. It sounds a little different from the usual spiel that we get from people who get caught, but as an athlete earning that kind of money, you have to understand what is going into your body, and ultimately it's you that puts it in there. The Hamilton Tiger Cats have announced the team's coaching staff for 2025, which includes James Tuck as running backs coach and special teams assistant. Will he be a good coach?
I think he will be. I don't know James Tuck personally, but I've been watching him play in the CFL for 11 years. And he's a guy who kind of did it all, right? He catched passes out of the backfield, get down there on special teams. Like, he had a great career, especially for a guy who, if I remember correctly, was a converted defensive lineman out of York University. So if you want a guy who's done it all, seen everything, been in the locker room, all that, I think this is a great hire for Hamilton. And nice to see him transition right from the field into the clubhouse. We've seen a few guys do that in recent years. James Tuck, best of luck. OUA All-Star QB Keegan Hall has transferred from Ottawa to York. Will that help the Lions improve on their McMaster to York? My apologies. Will that help the Lions improve on their win total in 2025?
It absolutely will. You're talking about a second team OUA All-Star, only exceeded in his presence by Taylor Elgersma, who we've talked extensively about as an NFL prospect. Is Keegan Hall going to be a legit CFL prospect? No, but he can be a difference maker at the U Sports level. And there has not been a QB like that at York, maybe ever. I think this is a huge move for that program. Nate Bahar has retired from professional football, finishing his career with 188 receptions for 2,015 yards and 4 touchdowns over 98 career games. How will you remember him?
I will remember Nate Bahar most for the 2014 Panda Game Hail Mary catch and his performance in that. Yes, I know it's not CFL, but it's a Canadian football podcast. That game will never be forgotten in the history of that rivalry. He was a solid CFL receiver and potentially, and I don't usually say this often, but an even better individual off the field. But that 2014 Panda Game was unbelievable. Look it up on YouTube if you've never seen it before. And he had a heck of a day in that game as well. The Toronto Argonauts are returning to the good old University of Guelph for training camp. The smartest move the team could make, Hodge. What's your take?
Obviously, it's a good move. In the last 4 years they've gone there, they've either finished first in the division or won the Grey Cup every year. And that's despite having a new starting quarterback every year, whether it's due to injury or, you know, moving on or whatever. So, yeah, how can you argue with it? Suspension. How can you argue with what the Argonauts are doing? Nobody would draw up their strategy as something to work towards, but it's working, and that's all that matters.
Last it's that one. Guelph magic, baby.
It's that Guelph magic. There you go. See, maybe that Guelph magic will work for you too, Justin, someday. But I've just lowered my price to 175. So you're not underbidding me for the commissionership of the CFL. Okay, 160. 160. Do I hear 160? Okay. My phone's still not ringing. The Berlin Thunder of the ELF have hired 6-time Grey Cup champion Adam Rita as their offensive coordinator at 77. How is this man still coaching?
Well, he's still coaching because he absolutely loves it. And for the uninitiated, Adam Riga has done a lot of work over in Europe since retiring from the CFL. He was the former head coach of the Barcelona Dragons in the ELF, stepped away from that role. I believe he was coaching like 6-man football in Sardinia last time I checked. But the Thunder's head coach is Canadian Jag Ball from out here in my neck of the woods. I believe he had a brief cup of coffee with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers that was derailed by injury. Now that he's taken back over the Thunder, he's brought in a familiar name to help him out on the offensive side of the ball. People love Adam Riga on the other side of the Atlantic, and for good reason. This is a guy who's just passionate about what he does.
We thank you, as always, for listening to the Three Down Nation podcast. For Justin Dunk and JC Abbott, I'm John Hodge. We thank you, as always, for listening. 150, 145, 140, 135. What? No, not happening. Okay. See ya.
Spring is in the air, and at Minky Couture, we're celebrating this joyful season with warmth, love, and the softest, coziest blankets. Whether you're cuddling up after an Easter egg hunt or gifting a little extra comfort to someone special, our luxury blankets make every moment even sweeter. From our Minky family to yours, happy Easter. May your day be filled with love, laughter, and all the cozy moments you can dream of. Visit us online at minkycouture.com or stop by one of our stores to find your perfect Minky hug today.